Well, in today's episode, I'm joined by David Higgins, Senior Director at CyberArk. And together, we're going to take a look at their latest UK research and what it revealed about some of the everyday habits that continue to put businesses at risk. For example, 71% of UK workers are experiencing a cyber attack in the last year. But, yep, many of them are still reusing passwords and accessing critical apps from unsecured personal devices. And those same people, they're worried more about online credit card fraud than workplace breaches, even though work-related attacks are nearly twice as common. So I want to learn more about that disconnect. And David's going to walk us through why this disconnect persists and how organisations can shift from blaming users to better supporting them, and supporting them with better identity-first security. And we'll also cover the rise of phishing and social engineering attacks, how they're evolving, how AI is making attacks even harder to spot, and what all this collectively means, especially now there are around 100 machine identities for every human one in UK enterprises. So from the future of agentic AI to just-in-time models, this is a conversation about how to build resilient, secure systems that work with human nature, not against it. And if you've ever wondered how to improve your organization's cyber hygiene without adding layers of friction, you're going to want to stay tuned. So with that scene set, it's time for me to officially introduce you to today's guest now. So thank you for joining me on the podcast today. Can you tell everyone listening a little about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, David Higgins, one of the field technology office at CyberArk. And what I've been doing over the last 15 years, if not longer, it could be longer, I lost track, kind of round down a little bit, is helping organizations in the world of all things identity and identity security.
Well, there's so much I want to dig deeper with you on today, because one of the reasons I invited you on was that your new research showed that 71% of UK workers have experienced a cyber attack in the past year. Possibly no surprise there. But why do you think risky habits like, dare I say, password reuse? We've all seen those PA55 word being used again and again. And when you take that and combine it with unsecured devices, they persist despite awareness. We all know what we're doing is wrong on occasions, and we keep skipping updates, keep reusing the same passwords. But why is this? Why are we not moving forward on this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I knew all the answers, but I do have some thoughts I could share with you, right? So yeah, we interviewed about 14,000 employees across the world to exactly unpick some of these things. You know, what are people doing in the workplace? What are their perceptions on security? And yeah, so some of the answers I think would keep security folk up at night for sure. It gave us an insight as well into generational differences, like differences between how Gen Z or Gen Z, which is my preference, versus the right baby boomers. And obviously you can imagine the more younger generations being more tech savvy, being more aware. But I think, you know, to your question around, you know, why do we still see things like password reuse and people using unsecured devices? The answer is it's probably that it's just a simpler route to do. It's the easiest thing for them to do. And I think there's a lot we can talk about awareness and why they're doing it. But like, as an example, in the survey, we found that 80% of people, you know, use a personal device for accessing work applications. Now, that on its own isn't necessarily a bad thing. Bring your own device. It's, you know, a thing many organizations have looked to embrace. But then when you twin it with also the fact that most of them admit that they delay or put off doing patch updates and security updates to their device, straight away, well, you know, those things are at conflict. You've got, you know, devices that have known vulnerabilities on them being used to access, you know, work applications. And then, yeah, my favorite thing, challenge of password reuse. We know what the issues are, but people still do it. And I have to say, I think it's just simply because it's the easier thing to do. But what I would say is that it comes back to, I think, a little bit of, is there a better option? Do they have better options to go about it? If we think about employees in the workplace and they're reusing the same passwords for systems they log in for work, are they doing that because they're lazy, or are they doing that because there isn't a better option available to them that gives them a more secure way that still makes their life easier? You know, as an example, 50% of the people we interviewed, I'm rounding up, it was 45, but 50% of the people we interviewed, they admit they share passwords with their colleagues. And again, we know that's a big no-no, but they do it because, all right, I've logged into this portal for this supplier we use, and actually now I need my colleague to log in and do some. It just happens so easily. But again, I think it comes down to that, yeah, there's awareness, maybe not full realization, but also perhaps there isn't better processes for them to do and address these challenges.
Yeah, I completely agree. And for anyone out there listening that is still unaware on why they shouldn't be reusing their password, you can pick any regular account that you have. Let's say a Spotify account. Spotify suffer a data breach. That password goes out there. The hacker straight away can put your email address and that password into a site that it probably knows that you already have. And I would say Netflix, Amazon, PayPal and all those kind of things. So that is the danger. But for a moment, let's assume that we've got a tech-savvy audience and they're being very good. They've got a password safe and they've got all their passwords safe in there. And it's a different password for every account. That is all great. But phishing remains a common attack vector in the UK. So what new tactics are you seeing there around phishing and social engineering in particular that make them harder to detect as well?
Yeah, so apologies. Second question in, and I'm going to answer straight away with artificial intelligence, right? Yeah. So that's been a game changer for sure. Like, take kind of deepfakes. So, you know, deepfake videos and deepfake audio. It is starting to be leveraged. You know, there's been examples, I don't know if yourself or listeners have heard of it, where you have North Korean hackers actually applying for jobs at organizations, because how many people do we employ these days? Because remote working, and you never physically meet them. So they've been able to trick employers to employing North Korean hackers because they can send fake images, fake videos, etc. And so that's been a big impact on social engineering. Once you're in those digital interactions, how do you really know it is that person kind of behind the screen? So generative AI definitely having a big role. I think because of generative AI, and just more generally, we're also seeing a lot more targeted, sophisticated social engineering. You know, gone are the days of, you know, that email we'll get from a prince in Africa saying he wants to deposit millions of pounds into a bank to help him out. Now we're getting very curated, targeted social engineering at individuals, and it becomes really difficult to spot. I remember hearing a story that someone said they got a social engineering email for someone pretending to be from their child's school, right? So that's really targeted, and which parent isn't going to be interested in opening an email to do with, you know, their children's schools? So we're seeing that for sure. The other two thing I'd say is, whenever we do anything in security and we react to risks, like we're talking about passwords and doing good hygiene, as you say, different password everywhere, then of course the next best thing would be multi-factor authentication and supporting passkeys, etc. Attackers try and react to those changes. So we've seen a lot more social engineering now at things like help desks and third parties. You know, can I dupe a help desk into resetting the login and the MFA token for someone I'm interested in? You know, maybe they're pretty tech savvy and they've not fallen victim of my social engineering attempts. So I'm going to go somewhere else in an attempt to compromise that user's identity. So we've seen that. But probably more worrying, and you mentioned about like data breaches, people, you know, passwords get stolen in various different data breaches, is credentials become commodities now. You can go on the dark net and go to marketplaces and purchase already stolen credentials. So on the one hand, you know, that's a worrying aspect that your credentials may be out there for sale. But also it means if someone wants to perform some other form of attack, whether it be ransomware or data exploitation, they probably don't even need to do the social engineering part anymore because they can go and purchase already available credentials. Attacks themselves becoming commoditized. Sorry, went off on a little bit of a tangent there, Neil, but hopefully helps with the question.
No, you really did. And I think social engineering is such an important topic because we've all seen, I don't know, a CEO attending a conference in San Francisco. The average user can then go to the company page and find out who the finance director or somebody in finance is. And then you can go to a trip to the website and get the email domain and fake that email in perfect English using AI. The barriers have almost been lowered now because all the information is there, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, for me, what I think it's doing in this security mindset, it's just enhancing this view of, we kind of have to assume breach. We have to assume that actually an attacker is going to get into our environment, and how do we defend ourselves with that notion? It enhances as well just further improvements, maturity around authentication. It can't just be about, you know, factors that they can provide, because they become they're very easily stolen these days. So you have to start taking other contexts into equations. Like, I give you that third party, you know, help desk scenario, right? So they call up, pretend to be me, convince them to reset my password and my multi-factor authentication token, and then they log in as me. But they can't mimic my behavior, right? They may be hackers from abroad. They may be, you know, trying to access certain systems that I don't typically try and access. So I think we also have to start bringing in other contexts to help organizations, like behavioral contexts, adaptive authentication processes.
And I think over the years, we've all seen those incredibly lazy headlines that just blame the workers for everything. And you've got a title of humans are the weakest link in cybersecurity. But thankfully, we are moving away from that. And we're increasingly seeing this idea of a human firewall, which I'm seeing getting mentioned more and more. So in your view, what's missing from employee training or policies that we see at the moment, which typically has been, I don't know, a compliance training thing that you've got to turn up to, hit next for 20 minutes and then forget about it again? So what should we be doing differently to strengthen that first line of defense or that human firewall?
Yeah, that's the great thing, right? As you say, we all get that annual security survey. You're like, oh, I've got 1,000 things to do, but I've got to click through this, otherwise my manager's on my case. And that's what they do. They just click through and it's great, past it, move on to the next thing. Did I consume any of the information? Probably not. And I think that's, you know, I can see why organizations have to do that. You have to demonstrate that you've got formalized processes, etc. But I don't know if it's really embedding people into the culture of security. So I think it is that movement away from some of those tedious annual things and making it more of a cultural thing and getting that awareness. I've seen some customers, for example, that I've worked with that do kind of awareness weeks. So they do like a cyber awareness week internally, and they, you know, share lots of things that they know themselves. They get external parties to come in and do presentations, and they make it available to the whole company just to build more awareness and get that going, and doing it in a different way, hopefully in engaging, fun presentations. Gamification is always an interesting one, right? I think, you know, testing, we talked about social engineering. So, you know, organizations do perform their own phishing on their own employees. And there's a gamification that kind of comes with it. You don't want to be that person that, I did click that link. Fortunately, it was a test, but so gamification kind of helps. But also, actually, and maybe I'm not directly answering your question here with this next point, but it's, I read an interesting article from the NCSC who kind of had thrown this debate into the mix of, you know, with social engineering, talking about the human being that weakest link, as you mentioned, who's really at fault if they do click the wrong link and open the wrong attachment? Is it the individual, or is it the security team that email hit them in the first place and that link executed? I'm not going to give an answer because I think that's a debate we could have for some time. But I think, you know, it also becomes, you talk about that human firewall, it has to be a two-pronged thing, because even with the best training and engagement in the world, we're going to have an off day. We're going to have a day where we've just got too much going on. It's a very well-crafted social engineering attempt, and we'll fall victim to it. So it's got to be a two-pronged thing, you know. Better engagement and cultural embedment of security, but still maintaining that assumed breach mindset I mentioned before.
And I think away from the workplace, as everyday users, we're getting more used to what we need to be looking out for in our own personal email and those text messages and emails and everything that comes through that are just trying to get people to react quickly. And many workers fear financial fraud more than workplace threats, and yet workplace breaches are more common. So what's behind that mismatch in perception?
Yeah, I think it comes down to who they perceive it's impacting little bit. So like, take, for example, if you walk into most offices, there's CCTVs, there's security guards, there's usually a turnstile and you've got to have your pass to go through it. And most employees don't begrudge that because, yes, they get it helps the organization, but I think there's also a realization that that helps keep them safe as well, right? And I don't know if that bridge has been made in the cybersecurity space, that actually, you know, threats that play out within the workplace don't just threaten the organization, but employees too, for varying different reasons, right? The other thing as well, I think, is there's a safety net feeling, I think, sometimes. If you're at home, you're less likely to do things than when you're at work, because it's almost like at work, well, we've got an IT security team. They're doing great stuff, right? I'm not too worried about doing it, right? Because, you know, as you mentioned, right, I think it's 72% worry about their credit cards being stolen, but 25% of the people interviewed don't worry about the work identity being stolen. And I think that's kind of perhaps part of it. What also is, I think, interesting on that whole financial fraud piece is when you hear about breaches and most organizations come out and say, right, you know, this has happened and it's not good. And, you know, we kind of all sympathize with those victims. And it's always the case of, but don't worry, your password hasn't been stolen. Your credit card information hasn't been stolen. We did lose some personal information. But if I had a choice between those two categories, take the credit card and password, I can change those, right? My name, I don't really want to change it. The date of birth, that's not changeable. My home address, well, with stamp duty and the, you know, price of houses, I don't want to change that either, right? But my password, I can change that. Credit card, it's not my money, it's the credit card's company's money. So again, you know, there's a safety net there. I saw a presentation from Frank, and his surname has fallen out of my head, but the guy that Catch Me If You Can was based on. Mm. And he talks about, for his children, he always gives them the credit card, not a debit card. Two reasons: credit scoring's big in the United States. But also, secondly, that financial fraud, you know, if your credit card's stolen and the criminals still use it, well, actually, typically the credit cards are refunded because it's the credit card's money, not your own. So, yeah, there is a mismatch there. I think we always naturally just think financial fraud's the thing to worry about. But actually, data loss is a huge pain.
And you mentioned it earlier already, but this is a tech podcast, so we've got to bring that word up again. AI, it's absolutely everywhere. AI everywhere is even a phrase that I'm hearing more and more. So I'm curious, from your viewpoint, how is this shift amplifying things like identity risk, particularly with the proliferation of machine credentials, etc.? What are you seeing here? Anything keeping you up at night?
Not keeping me up at night. That's usually just, you know, children and dogs and that kind of stuff keeping me up. But now I think there are three interesting areas with AI and security, and it's AI as the attacker, which we kind of touched on a little bit. How are attackers starting to leverage that technology or become more sophisticated, not so much with their attack techniques, but the crafting of social engineering? That's a concern for sure. There's the implications of AI as the defender. Actually, well, what benefits can we use, right? Automation, detect threats faster, respond to them quicker, you know, take some of the workload off our, you know, stretch teams and, you know, allow AI to automate it. So that's a positive. But I think the future threat that we need to be tracking is exactly as you mentioned, the kind of implications of machine identity, especially when we kind of concern things like agentic AI. So agentic AI, like, let's take a concept, I don't know, let's say a recruitment process. You have an AI agent that receives all the applications and processes them, and then we'll take that information and pass it to another AI agent that starts to read through the resumes and cherry pick the right ones. And then another AI agent that communicates with internal, you know, whoever the recruiter is internally, say, right, actually, these are the ones I've picked out. A simplified example, right? But as you kind of look at that, you've got AI agent talking to AI agent, talking to employee, probably talking to databases and repositories. And from an identity perspective, they all need to be identified. They all need to be authenticated and they all need authorization. So I think as we start to embrace agentic AI more, that's probably the next big threat area is, as an attacker, could I exploit those identities and use it? Could I send the agents rogue and get them to start revealing information to me on the down low without people necessarily realizing it? So there's huge benefits to, you know, the embracement of agentic AI, but definitely identity threats we need to be aware of. Because the other challenge is, before AI kind of took off, we had human users, right? They've got behavioral patterns. And then we got machine identities, and they're very programmatical. They do the same thing over and over and over again. But with agentic AI, you set it a goal. You say, right, this is what you need to achieve. This is your goal. Go off and do it. And then they continually find ways to make that more efficient and improve. So agentic AI and the identities they use are a real challenge because they sit between human users. They have behavioral patterns that change, but they're not human. They're machine, right? They still are, you know, they're not flesh and blood, etc., right? So they kind of sit in that middle. And as I say, definitely an area that we need to be starting monitoring. It's something we're already looking at for sure as we look 25 and 26 beyond.
You've raised so many great points there, because I think 2025 will be remembered as the year of agentic AI and AI agents. So many enterprises filling their workplace with AI agents, different departments having their own agents, talking to different agents throughout the business. And you've mentioned that there's something like 100 machine identities for every human one in the UK workplace. So just with anyone that thinks about the mistakes that we've made in the past through moving fast and breaking things, how should businesses be at least rethinking their identity security strategy in this machine-dominated environment that we're finding ourselves?
Yeah, it's a staggering number. And just to let you know, so we've got that stat now. It was a year ago or 2 years ago, it was 45 to 1. So you can see the growth is happening, and I can't see that ratio coming down. If anything, it's going to increase. Agentic AI, part of that for sure. But then also other things such as, you know, Internet of Things, IoT devices, think CCTV cameras, smart cars, etc. These are all forms of machine identity that need to communicate to systems. It's an ever-growing landscape. And I think that what I see in the identity space sometimes is, like, we know there's a challenge with machine identities. It's a very technical challenge. It's a complex one. Let's perhaps put that off. We're going to come to it for sure, but we've got some other priorities we need to address immediately. And what I'd say is this problem isn't going away. So it's almost like, okay, don't put it off. Don't put it down the road. Create kind of offerings, secure offerings now to teams, and essentially kind of stem the flow. It's kind of like, well, we're creating new machine identities all the time. We need to make sure they're secured in the right way. Anything new, guys, you've got the server, start using it. And then we need to start unpicking, you know, what's already out there in terms of machine identities. And then another thing to kind of consider, I think, for professionals in this space is align to your own digital strategy. And what I mean by that is, right, so organizations have hybrid environments. They're on-prem data centers. They're using software as a service, platform, infrastructure as a service. And they'll have machine identities across all those stacks. But if, you know, the strategy from the CIO is, look, we're going cloud only. We're closing data centers. We're going that direction. Don't worry about fixing the security gaps on the on-prem stuff, because it's eventually going to disappear. Again, kind of put those focuses on the new side, because actually cloud is where we see a huge increase in machine identities as well. Automation is all facilitated through machine-to-machine communication.
And we've raised so many important issues today, and certainly a lot of food for thought. So I always try and give everyone listening a few practical takeaways. So what practical advice do you have for any company or business leader that want to improve their security posture and cyber hygiene without adding unwanted friction to the user experience? I know it's a huge question that is almost a podcast episode on its own, but any advice there?
Yeah. So I think the first thing would be to, with the user community and the security teams, admit, look, there is no such thing as frictionless security. I know it's controversial, but there isn't, right? The easiest thing to do would be to allow employees to access whatever they wanted with no authentication whenever they wanted, right? But we know that's not the right thing to do. If you're regulated, you're going to be in big trouble for doing it. So there is going to be an aspect of friction, but it's, I think some of the things to do is, one, firstly, whenever there's a vulnerability that's been identified, you know, a threat vector that's been identified, try and understand the root cause as to why that exists in the first place. Sometimes in security, we kind of, there's an immediate vulnerability, let's slap something on top to mitigate that risk. But actually, why did it come about in the first place, right? So taking the identity space, we have users who have, in some scenarios, far more permissions and privileges than others. And naturally, they're a high-risk target because you take over that identity, you get a lot of access. And so it can be it's a thing of, like, let's put some more governance around their usage. They've got to go through approval workflows and check. But actually, is the challenge really not that actually early on in the process, we drop that user into so many groups that they become hugely privileged? Is that not the root cause? And maybe move to more of a just-in-time type model where you give users the privileges as they need them and revoke them afterwards. So that would be one thing to kind of consider, because you could still maintain user experience there. You're just solving the problem in a different way. So that would be one thing. The second, and it's really easy for me to say, but it's that engagement with the user community. Actually truly understand what it is that they do. Share with them, you know, really what the objective is of security, which sometimes, and, you know, it won't be surprising for me to hear, say, I think sometimes security gets a negative rep you know, in organizations. And it's like, well, look, we're not here to be horrible and slow them down. It's that, you know, we don't get joy from people's pain. It's we're working as one unit. It's that culture we talked about before, right? There's a reason security is there. It's to mitigate the risk of the organization, which we all work for. So let's work together. We found these issues. Let's work together on the best way to kind of resolve them. But as you mentioned, I think really leaning into the user experience is important, and that, like, implications of change. Be cognizant of what they are. Sometimes it will need to be impacted because that's the nature of security. I talked about, you know, turnstiles in the office. That adds a little bit of friction for people getting to the office, right? So there's always going to be a little bit of friction, but it needs to be, you know, a joined up process between security and the end user community.
And this Daniel Burris, who's a futurist I've spoken to on the podcast before, he always says that it's easy to predict the future by monitoring soft and hard trends. Soft trends are something that you think might happen based on what you're seeing, and hard trends are what you know is going to happen from everything that you're seeing. And I think after this year, with everything going around agentic AI and AI agents, we know for sure that the future is going to involve every department, every partner, every supplier, every customer, all having their own little army of AI agents. So with that inevitable future, what role do you think identity first security will play in preventing that inevitable next wave of enterprise breaches?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, right, this huge investment happening in AI, it's we're seeing positive things in the news. We are seeing some negative things in the news too, right? You see some of the big technology players out there claiming they're downsizing because they've got efficiencies from agentic AI. So regardless of people's views on that, the fact is, to your point, there's the hard trends. It's happening, right? We talked about already kind of protecting the AI agent identities. I think that's going to be something we need to do. The other thing you said about kind of keeping me up at night, again, doesn't keep me up at night, but, you know, as I sit on a train into London or something, it does ponder as I go through these things. If you kind of think about, so we have agentic AI performing tasks. We have AI that we interact with as people. And it's amazing how many people are already using it for generation of reports, of presentations. And I have heard some crazy stories, which I won't reveal, but crazy stories of personal questions people ask AI, right? And it's this understanding of, guys, firstly, where's that data going, right? Yeah. Secondly, right, you be conscious of what you're sharing. But secondly, what information is it sharing back? What's driving those responses? We've got to make sure that as well, that AI is on a secure bed, is on a secure infrastructure. Because think about it, if people just go to ChatGPT or, you know, Gemini or whatever it is and ask it questions, and it starts to influence what people think and what people think the answer is. If you can start to manipulate the, you know, the AI engines and algorithms to start, you know, kind of positioning your preference, whatever it is, your narrative, I think that's something as well we need to be kind of conscious of. You know, for the last 5 years or 10 years now, it kind of feels like, you know, we've heard about fake news, that's fake news, and people not sure what truth is on social media. You know, we've got to be worried about as well keeping that AI infrastructure secure, because if that's where everyone goes to now for that information, that's also going to start shaping narratives.
Wow, so much to take away, so much to think about there. So thank you so much for sharing your insights with everyone today. But before I let you go, we're going to have a little bit of fun with you. If you thought these were tough questions, we've saved the hardest till last. And that is the huge responsibility of adding a song to our Spotify playlist. Guilty pleasures are allowed, but what would you like to add and why?
Well, hopefully people don't groan immediately. So it's a song from Oasis. But hear me out, all right? A few reasons for that, right? So it was one of the first bands I ever saw in a large concert. It was at Old Wembley before the towers were taken down. So I saw them live there. I thought it was amazing until I watched the recording on Sky and realized that Liam had probably had a bit too much to drink before he started singing and didn't sound too great. But when 90,000 people are singing, no one's complaining. Also going to go see them this year. Don't ask me how much I spent. It's eye-watering amounts, right? Because the ticket prices. But the song I picked is The Master Plan. If people don't know it, it's a song that Noel Gallagher says it's the best song he ever wrote, but it never made it as a main track. It never made it as a single day release. Didn't make it onto a main album. It actually was a B-side to the Oasis CD single. which is probably their most famous song, but Noel kind of positions The Master Plan as his best that he's ever written. And I wouldn't argue with him. It's one of my favorites. And so I thought it was a great one to add to the list. Because as we kind of talked about today, you know, the song's really about, you don't really know what you know. Things, there is no master plan, right? And, you know, things are always changing. I think that's a great reflection of what we talked about in the security space. And also, Noel was just writing this song to add more B-sides. Sometimes our best work we do when we don't even realize.
Oh, man, what a great choice and a great reason. I completely agree with you. I think some of Oasis's best tracks were the B-sides. Acquiesce is another classic there, of course. And I'm curious, is there two different versions of the ticket price there, one that you paid, one that your wife, you've told your wife how much it costs?
It does change. When she asked me, how much were those tickets? I think it was this much. Are you sure? I'm rounding down every month.
Well, best of luck for the concert there. I'd love to find out how you get on there. What a great night that will be. But more than anything, thank you for coming on today. And for anyone listening wanting to learn more about the report we referenced, some of the work you're doing at CyberArk, where would you like to point everyone?
Yeah, so look, I think really straightforward, you know, is hit the website. So that we've talked about the report at the start. So you can get that available. You can access that off the, you know, www.cyberarc.com and get that downloaded for free. Really interesting insight. We also just released another report as well, the Identity Security Landscape Report, which looks at all aspects of identity. Again, free to get to access. Great reading for those stuck on commuter trains, etc. So check out the website and access those reports for sure.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I will add links to absolutely everything there, including the actual report. There's some powerful stats in there. Most powerful, of course, is always reusing password across work and personal accounts. There's some big figures there. But I urge everyone listening to check that out. But I'm going to go add that song to the playlist now, Master Plan. I've not heard that in a few years. It's a great tune. So I'll get that added. But just thank you for joining me today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Neil. It's been a pleasure.
As David pointed out today, the gap between what employees know and how they act remains one of the biggest vulnerabilities in cybersecurity. And it's not because they don't care, but because our systems often make the secure route the hardest one to take. And rather than layering in more compliance or running through yet another tick box training session, I think maybe it's time to rethink how we approach security culture. From reducing privileges to introducing new user-aware design. I think the future of cyber resilience lies in simplicity, adaptability, and a more mutual understanding between IT and the wider business. But here's where it gets urgent. AI agents are currently flooding the workplace. It's everywhere in our newsfeed at the moment. 2025 is all about agents, AI agents, agentic AI. So with 100 machine identities for every human one, we've already entered a world where machines talk to machines without oversight. And that raises a new kind of question. If identity is the new perimeter, who's watching the digital work for? What are you doing today to secure the systems that your AI agents are going to be using tomorrow? Let me know your thoughts. I'd love to hear your take on how your organization is approaching this challenge and indeed many of the ones that David raised today. So email me, techblogwriter@outlook.com, X, LinkedIn, Instagram, TikTok, just at Neil C. Hughes. I'm interested in your takeaways and how you're dealing with these issues. So I look forward to speaking with you all again next time we join forces. When you hit refresh on your podcast feed, I'll be right back here with another guest. But let me know what you thought of today's, and I'll speak with you all again very soon.